Welcome to the Untribal Podcast, the show that gives you news content by regular people for regular people. Untribal Politics is committed to providing ordinary folk with the platform to speak up about big issues, no matter how marginalised the group or what corner of society you come from. Just days ago, I was approached by a campaigner for COVID Action Scotland to tell us about the concerns raised over masks in health and social care, and delighted to be joined today by Hannah Hassan, who's representing that campaign. How are you doing today, Hannah? You all right?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very much well. Hannah, who are you and what brings you here?
So, I'm a member of COVID Action Scotland. We are a campaign group mainly trying to raise awareness about the potential risks of COVID and highlight how badly we think COVID has been managed in Scotland and across the world as well. But I'm so glad you've invited me to speak with you today. There was a letter sent by the Scottish Government to health and social care settings about the withdrawal of the mask guidance, which came into effect yesterday. So what that means is that health and social care staff in care homes and hospitals and GP surgeries and other settings will now no longer be allowed to wear a mask if they choose to do so. They are reverting back to the pre-COVID guidance on when it is appropriate to wear a mask. And these are for things like suspected infectious diseases and respiratory illnesses. But COVID is now not being included in this risk, and it is being treated like any other respiratory illness, which we think is devastating for patients and for staff. Health and social care staff have had their pay and conditions eroded since well before COVID, and they've had a huge amount of pressure and responsibility put on them just in the last 3 years, and they've not for a long time not been adequately supported by governments to do their jobs safely. There has been a lot of concerns raised over the years about patient safety, and this is things like under-resourcing and underfunding, but also understaffing and just poor planning and poor policies that put the staff at risk and the patients at risk as well. So we are really upset about this. Having staff revert to pre-COVID guidance is not a common sense thing to do when COVID is still spreading and the pandemic is still ongoing. And even if staff wanted to bring their own PPE in to protect themselves now that it's no longer going to be provided, it's just come at the wrong time during a cost of living crisis when everybody is struggling financially, and asking health and social care staff, who are quite low paid, let's be honest, to provide their own PPE is just wrong and irresponsible.
So you said that there's been a ban on mask wearing. Is it not just become a choice rather than a ban on people wearing it, if that makes sense?
So it was a choice before. The guidance was still that we will provide they will provide masks to visitors and to staff who choose to wear them. But now they will no longer provide that, and staff will only be allowed to now wear a mask in these certain settings.
Okay.
Following the guidance that it was before COVID for, suspected dangerous diseases, which COVID's not a part of anymore, apparently.
And you know what people are going to say is, we're so done with the pandemic, we can't be bothered. Why are you bothered about this again? What do you say to these people?
I think a part of the reasoning that the Scottish Government have used is that we now have a highly vaccinated population, right? And vaccines have been really good to reduce death and severe illness, but we're not really seeing vaccines protecting people from things like long COVID and other long-term illnesses that COVID is causing. And we're certainly not seeing a reduction in transmission. And it's really important to stress that death and severe illness that needs hospitalisation is not the only risk here. It's not the only thing that is a risk to people's health. And I think it's come at quite a timely, it's quite timely that the WHO have just announced the end of the emergency phase of the pandemic, whilst they also said in the same statement that 10% of infections are leading to things like long COVID. So
Well, that's interesting because, I remember getting that notification from Sky News on my phone and it literally said pandemic over. I was like, oh, well, thank God for that. And I'm sure loads of people were doing that. I didn't realize that that was in the same statement. I certainly looked at that letter that you're referring to, Hannah, and it said, as they said, they've done a review and they followed a recommendation and there's high levels of vaccination now. There's low levels of deaths and severe hospitalization, but it's interesting that you mentioned that figure of 10% giving people long COVID, because I am someone that can speak personally on the quite severe effects of long COVID. I mean, I didn't know that I had ME before I got COVID as well on top of it. And Jesus, it absolutely blew me out of the water for about 6 months. I was literally couch bound for 6 months. I'm slowly getting better, but I go through fluctuations and I go through relapses.
That's true.
I wanted to read people a statement that I sent out with Untribal the other day because it was ME Awareness Day on the 12th of May. And just to give people an idea of what we're talking about when we're talking about long COVID, because it's become a little bit of a flippant statement. People are like, oh, that sounds terrible, and they don't really understand the kind of things and the effects that it has. And the other day I wrote, today is myalgic infilibrad. I can't even pronounce it. It's
Myalgic and careful myalitis.
oh my, I've got it and I can't even pronounce it. Awareness Day, a day in which we recognize the millions missing, a day in which we recognize the constant suffering of headaches, throat aches, muscle aches, fever, sinus problems, swollen glands, stomach pain, nausea, sleep disruption, cognitive impairment, memory, concentration, night sweats, joint pain, cramps, and twitches. A day we recognize that, yes, it is constant, no matter how hard that is for people to wrap their head around. As we're speaking just now, I actually have a headache as we're speaking, but I've gotten so used to doing this job whilst I'm suffering these symptoms that I'm able to continue. Don't worry about me, though, I'm all good. A day we recognize that we don't always talk about our symptoms when they're happening because the 24 hours would literally consist of negative conversations for the whole entire day. A day we recognize that people aren't pretending to be sick, they're pretending to be well. A day we recognize the struggle of recognition, the depression, the stress, the panic attacks, the worry, the embarrassment that comes with it. A day we recognize forgetting what it feels like to start and end your day without pain, the feeling of battle to live your life. A day we recognize doing anything to get a release, a taste of normality, or a moment without pain, even though we know it'll kind of come back and hurt us somewhere down the line. Constant assessment of how we're feeling, constant compromise of health for enjoyment, constant anxiety for what may come next, the hours, the days, the months, the years of lying on your couch, sensitivity to light, sound, and heat holding you back from watching the telly or listening to a podcast, the effect that people has on families, the loneliness, the lack of physical interaction, the lack of warmth through community. And most importantly, we recognize a day that a brave face doesn't always mean someone is okay. And by gosh, there is more symptoms that come with ME that people are not aware of, and it fluctuates and varies in severities and effects on people. It's not all the same for people. And when we're talking about the 10% of transmissions of people getting long COVID, these are the kind of experiences that we're talking about giving people, and that's a statistic I had no idea about before you came on today.
It is quite a list, that, isn't it? And it is. This is exactly why we believe that we can't go back to normal, and we certainly can't carry on this path of pretending that it's 2019, because it's just not. COVID is here to stay, and it's really important for us to understand that, and not to be acting like it is 2019. We're still living during the pandemic as we speak. And that means that people's workplaces have just got a whole lot more risky, that people's health in general is a lot worse, that there is this exponential rise in post-viral fatigue and other autoimmune diseases. Like mine personally, I have an autoimmune disease that was triggered by a virus as well. People, heart conditions, exponential increases in that, and life expectancies dropped all across the world at the exact time that this pandemic came along. So going back to normal is something that you do at your own risk, but it's not really your own risk, is it? It is not our responsibility to live in society and mitigate these risks. It is the responsibility of governments to make sure that we can interact with society as active participants, that we can have workplaces that are not harmful to our health. And they've fucking miserably failed at that, haven't they? Totally, utterly failed. And it is the people who are going to suffer.
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned care homes and the whole scandal that came with that, with the amount of people that died in care homes during the pandemic. Do you think that adds a layer of moral sort of grievance in this decision that you're campaigning against on Saturday?
Yeah, absolutely think it shows that the Scottish Government are in, they're just having this ableist attitude that people with underlying health conditions and older people's lives and their health and well-being and their quality of life doesn't matter, that it's just collateral damage somehow. And that's absolutely disgraceful to me. And that was what the EHRC found when it looked into care homes in Scotland during 2020 and 21. They found that there was human rights breaches with regards to disabled people and older people. And the Scottish Government admitted that. They admitted that they had got it wrong and they didn't act quickly enough and they didn't include disabled people and older people and patient groups as part of these decisions as how they were going to manage the pandemic. And it was, I think it's even more disgraceful because we should be learning from these previous mistakes that we've made, and obviously an unprecedented situation. But the fact that they've not learned from these mistakes is just, I think it's absolutely disgraceful.
And
And to the
I
staff as well, the staff who work in had to work under these conditions, knowing fine well that this wasn't an ideal situation, and it's like history's repeating itself.
sorry to interrupt you there. I was just I thought you'd ended, but I did mention that there was a campaign going on Saturday. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that and what that entails and sort of
Yeah.
where it is and stuff? Yeah.
So COVID Action Scotland, the group I'm a part of, and Long COVID Kids, which is a charity that was set up by people whose children have got COVID in school and are now suffering with long COVID, and some other groups and individuals as well, we're going to be holding a banner protest outside the Scottish Parliament on Saturday, the 20th, at 3:30 at the visitors' entrance. And we want to do this to raise awareness and just resist this policy of, blatantly just putting staff and patients at completely avoidable and unnecessary risk of repeatedly being infected with COVID and the potential long-term harms of that for people's health.
Do you
So
think
come
that
along.
I will, if I've got the energy on Saturday, I will definitely see you there. Do you think that there's a potential for a kind of like another spike in terms of like what we've seen during the pandemic? I know the campaign leaflet mentions that there's still 60 people killed each week in Scotland alone. Is that 60 people that have died that have been recorded with COVID? Is that a direct cause? Does it matter? Like what is
This
that figure?
is extremely difficult because the Scottish Government have stopped collecting a lot of data and publishing a lot of data around where COVID is on the death certificate, for example. So if someone is dying with COVID or because of COVID, which is quite an arbitrary thing for me to understand. But the ONS survey has stopped, so we don't actually have an insight as to how many people at any given time have COVID. There is some other predictions like the Zoe COVID study, which is a really good one. They have made lots of different predictions, just mapping and extrapolating people who are getting tests done in hospital and done privately. But we actually don't know the real figures. But there is some evidence from countries like Australia and South Korea, which are similar to ours in that their populations are highly, highly vaccinated populations. And their death rates of COVID in hospital are 10% of patients. And those are of patients who acquire their COVID infection from a hospital setting, which means that they've been in hospital for something else. They've got underlying health conditions, comorbidities. They've got COVID in hospital, and 10% of those people are unfortunately passing away. And I just think that the Scottish government is not raising enough awareness of the fact that there are potential risks here, not just of death and hospitalisation, but really the longer term impacts of COVID infections that we're 3 years in to the pandemic, and we can already start to see the scale of long-term illness. If we just think about what that's going to look like in 10 years' time, I really think it's not looking good.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not looking good. So do you think the figures that we've seen during the pandemic, do you think it was actually way higher in terms of the deaths from COVID and stuff? Do you think what we were fed, or do you think, I'm not like alluding to you to being something sort of like conspiracy theorist or anything. What I'm just asking you is, do you think the impact of COVID was actually potentially a lot bigger than what we were fed through the statistics that we've seen on news channels during the day and stuff?
I mean, I couldn't really speak to the specifics of that. I do know that at the beginning of the pandemic, the predictions and the projections were that there would be a lot higher death rates. I don't think it was considered at all that the long-term health implications of COVID before that first wave hit us. And so I think the government have struggled to adapt their approach to understanding that maybe they overestimated how many people were going to die at the start, and they definitely underestimated the long-term health impacts of infections. But I really couldn't comment on that because I'm not really sure.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Like, I know a lot of people, have been very vocal about these things, and I mean, I think back to the sort of conspiracy theories that it was, to do with 5G, and there was these
Oh
towers, all
yeah.
that kind of thing. I wasn't trying to tie you into anything like that. I was just wondering if you thought the figure was higher. And it's interesting because you mentioned the Scottish government, because I've seen, like, the Scottish Lib Dems, for example, have been very vocal about this, and they've been, one of their sort of main policy agendas of late is justice for long COVID sufferers. I think there's something like 200,000 in Scotland right now, and it's very difficult in order to get sort of support for that. And mainly because it's difficult to diagnose. It's very vague. It's very sensory. It's not, you can't see the physical damage a lot of the time. So, they've been putting the government under quite a lot of pressure. And when I had Alex Cohamilton on, I think this was quite a few months ago, to be fair. He said he wasn't getting anywhere in terms of where the government was going. Again, a lot of things in Scottish politics are very politicized now, so it's sometimes hard to read between the lines with these things. But in terms of, I mean, you must be monitoring and do the kind of things that the government is doing. What kind of things has the government doing in the past 6 months in order to help long COVID sufferers? Have they been up too much? Is there anything that you know of? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so there was the COVID recovery, the COVID-19 recovery committee. They did an evidence session with lots of different people, including doctors that have set up their own long COVID practices, experts on ME, campaigners, patient groups with long COVID. This evidence session these There was lots of different evidence sessions that were ongoing, and it is very, very clear that the government is not doing enough to raise awareness of the scale and the impact of post-viral illnesses. So not just things like long COVID and myalgic encephalomyelitis and chronic fatigue syndrome, but also other things like vascular complications, heart disease, and all these other things that we're seeing. There is an extremely low amount of public awareness of these issues. And so while we need to look into treatments and clinics for people with long COVID, we also need to understand that the best thing we can do now with the tools that we've got is prevent long COVID happening to more people whilst we set up the infrastructure to deal with that. And the policy in place now in Scotland is to get COVID. There are now, especially when masks are going to be withdrawn from healthcare settings, there are now no mitigations protecting people from getting COVID. And we're going to see a whole lot more long COVID patients as this continues. So the government, whatever it is that government are spending their money and their energy on, is the absolute wrong area.
Yeah, I mean, and it's difficult. It's really difficult to treat. I mean, as a member of the ME community, ironically, to put a positive spin on the pandemic, it's the best thing that's happened to ME sufferers in terms of the awareness to that illness, because it really was, people didn't really know about it. I mean, if you said to someone, that you had ME about 4 or 5 years ago, they probably wouldn't even take a second interest because they wouldn't know what you were talking about. But now that the long COVID thing has come into play, there's been a lot more awareness and research put into it.
That's
And
right.
just speaking from experience, like, so when I was, I mean, I've been suffering these symptoms for years, but I was still living my life before. So like, I started getting like headaches and throat aches, like really recurrently for like since I was about 18. But I was still like going about my life. I was still working. I was still playing football and that. But it just went, it started becoming like fevers, and it started becoming like viral infections, or at least that's what it felt like at the time. And it got to the point where I was off work like for 2 weeks every month, and they thought I was at it. Like, I was working at a call center, and literally every day I was like, here, my throat is absolutely fucked. Like I need to go home. And they were looking at me going, are you sure you want to do that? Are you sure you want to do that? Because like, there'll be a disciplinary waiting for you when you come back. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you, but like, my throat is so sore. So that was recurring for quite a while, but I was still like, sort of, I was still living my life. Like, I remember, like, I used to play football, and when I got exercising, I was all right. And then it was when I like stopped exercising that like the sore throat would start to come like immediately. I'd be in the like bus back from football, just being like in so much pain, thinking like, what the hell is that? I didn't know what it was. And then when I got COVID, that amplified it significantly. Like, I was talking like properly bedbound for several months. Slowly started to come out of it, and it was only at that time people started to realize, oh shit, like long COVID is a thing. Like, this was before. I mean, at the very start, we weren't even testing. We didn't even really know what it was. It was really unawares of all these things. I went on a bit of a rant here. I don't know where I started.
What you said is really important, and I would like to speak to that about you, what you said that was happening to you at work. So the TUC have done a recent report. I think it came out just at the end of March there. The ONS figures from January of this year showed that 2 million people in the UK have got long COVID. That's in 3 years. 2 million people have got long COVID in 3 years. I understand that chronic illness it is a part of life, and I think it's something like 25% of the global population have a disability or and a chronic illness. But 2 million people in 3 years, I don't think is just a part of life. I think this is a very, very scary thing that has happened during this pandemic. And the report goes on to talk about how this is affecting people's work. So the risk of long COVID increases with every infection, by the way. The job losses that we've seen, the discrimination that has been recorded for people at work because of the lack of recognition as to, what long COVID is and the many, many hundreds of symptoms that it will include, which is different for each person. There is also this, this toxic work culture that we have to like presenteeism, where we're encouraged by our employers to go to work if we're sick. We're encouraged to just shut up and get on with it. People are desperately worried about disclosing a diagnosis of long COVID or ME or anything else to their employer because they are worried about being discriminated against. And employers are not supporting people to have flexible working adjustments, reasonable adjustments, because, let's be honest, long COVID is a disability. It is a chronic health condition, and people deserve to have reasonable adjustments at work. And, we're not going to see the economy coming back to normal. We're not going to see people participating in the labour market at the scale we were seeing it before COVID when this is going on. So, what was it? The other news story that was out the other day, that the ONS statistics showed that 400,000 people have exited the labour market since COVID due to ill health. And these will be things related to a lot of it is post-viral illness. And that is just, this push that we have to get back to the office and get back to work and get back to normal. This is a financial thing. I think that, if we take a step back and really, really think about what this push to get back to normal means, it is capitalism, isn't it? I mean, this approach, it doesn't have workers' health at heart, it doesn't have our best interests at heart. Capitalism doesn't do that. It wants to make as much money as quickly as possible. And so the Scottish Government are driving this by dropping mitigations, saying that it's actually for the economy, and saying that it is the right time to drop all these mitigations without evidencing that properly or speaking to these long-term risks that we're seeing. I'll just give an example or a couple of examples of that. The things like facial recognition technology that the UK government spent, I think it was 3 million, according to the Mayor of London Office for Policing and Crime. And a culture change that adopts and supports mitigations like mask wearing isn't, it makes that investment inadequate. It makes the investment in facial recognition inadequate. And we also see this with companies that are driving people to get back to the office. A lot of these companies have spent a lot of money in kind of modding out their office spaces, making them cool and trendy to optimize productivity, job satisfaction. A lot of these cool companies have a nice kitchen, a bar, pool table in them. And if people want to largely start working from home or even be flexible, it makes it a bad investment for this company, having spent all this money on making the office space cool. So the companies might say that we value in-person collaboration and blah blah blah, but it is very explicitly a financial interest that in getting people to come back to the office to make sure that their money has been well spent. We also see this in climate policy, where so many powerful people have a vested interest in the oil and gas industry, which is why we don't see any action in moving towards renewables, and we see a lot of excuses and resistance to that. And I also understand that, if we actually wanted to safeguard the economy, actually making workplaces safe through mitigations such as, national or even international air quality standards, ventilation, testing staff, providing them with adequate sick pay, which we don't fucking have in this country, let's be honest. If we had a situation like that where the actual real well-being economy was in place, we wouldn't be worried about the economy, and we would actually support and be grateful for these really easy mitigations like ventilation, air quality, and masking as a society.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely spot on to that. And just to add to that, I never remembered the start of the what I was going on before, and I was talking about the difficulty in treating these people, and you mentioned the 400,000 figure that have left left the working economy, and to basically to talk about my own experience and how it kind of works. So I got diagnosed at the infectious diseases unit. They recommended I go see a spe I went and seen a specialist. This is all in the NHS, by the way. This is all
At the
like
West,
man
sorry.
out. No, so it was, yeah, at the Western, sorry, yeah,
Yeah.
at the Western. They recommended that in a report. I went to a specialist, got it confirmed, right? And then what happens then is a GP will tell you, yeah, we'll probably put you on antidepressants to try and help your mental state. You should maybe seek counseling as well, just to keep you going. And then I'm like, okay. So I came back, and after all these years of suffering and searching for what was wrong with me, like I go back to my family and say, yep, so yeah, this is what it is. And they were kind of like, well, so you're left to your own devices now. What's happening? And I was like, oh no, no, like I've and to be fair, it was a big moment for me because I finally got that clarity and recognition, and it all made sense then. But they were kind of like, well, yeah, but what happens now? And I had to like press them to get a specialist to like see like an actual ME specialist. It turns out there's no such thing in the Scottish NHS. I went to I was referred to the psychology department at Astley Ainslie, who deal with people like myself but are psychologists. They're not ME specialists. And the kind of thing that they recommended is basically stopping your whole life and then figuring out what is your threshold of activity that you can do in a day without triggering any kind of symptoms. So not even like the slight, like getting like a slight headache or just something that's bearable, like starting with something that you can't, like triggers nothing. So I was starting to do this, and they were like, try and repeat throughout the day. So it was like, get up, take a shower at the same time at say 11 o'clock, have your lunch at 12, go for a 10-minute walk at 1, and then that was it. That was your day. And then start again, and then start again. And then you were trying to build up for weeks, and I lost my mind doing this. It was like I couldn't do it. And
They call
then,
it pacing, don't they?
yeah, like
Yeah.
pacing, and I just couldn't do it. It just doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
And it's just to sort of exemplify that these 400,000 people, if we were to say that they had a chronic illness like mine, this is the kind of treatment that is the appropriate treatment for these kind of people. And no one can do it. Like I couldn't do it. Like I like for example, I would rather do this podcast, go and lie in my bed in pe pain for 6 hours afterwards, knowing that I've actually done something with my day and something that I care about and feel passionate about, than this long term project of trying to get better over a long space of time. And the mental toil that that gives you actually just makes you feel worse. And we know how important your mental phenomena is in your physical state these days. And just to give an example of how difficult it actually is for these people.
It's not okay. It's really not okay that, this is happening on such a scale. Like I said before, chronic illness is a part of life, and I think when you have a chronic illness like we do, you accept it. But this is fundamentally different. They are aware, the Scottish Government and all the other governments for that matter, they are aware of the scale that this is happening to people, and they're doing nothing to stop it. And a simple thing like wearing a mask in a hospital setting where there are sick people, where there are COVID patients, is a very, very small ask. And for the Scottish Government to turn around and say it's time for all that to be over, it is disgraceful, and it is going to cause this for more people down the line. And I just don't want to be a part of that. I just don't want, I'm quite ashamed, actually. I'm ashamed that the Scottish Government is doing this. I'm totally, totally ashamed of them for putting people in this situation, putting people at unnecessary risk that's preventable. It's so frustrating, and it's not fair for, people to bear that burden. Because when people do down the line realise that this has happened on such a scale because of the lack of mitigations, people are rightly going to be angry at the government. And then what are they going to do? What are they going to do? Apologize again, like they did when there was the care home scandal. It's just not good enough. I'm just really.
And obviously there's now a As I said, there's a bit of a stigma attached to people that, still care about these things, essentially, because people are so done with it. It was that, horrible a time that people simply want to forget about it. I think you mentioned that you received some social media abuse about this as well. How do you sort of deal with that stigma, and what still drives you in this passion to help people?
I'm quite forgiving, actually. I think that people are generally so desperate to move on from this pandemic. It has been shit. It's been totally traumatizing and life-changing for most of us, and that's not always in a good way. But at the same time, the facts are that repeated infections are going to continue to harm people financially, their physical health, their mental health, and in terms of just their general quality of life and life satisfaction. And I can't speak for anybody else when I say for me that I'm still not okay either. I am very much not okay, and especially so now that the government wants me to pretend that everything is fine and to carry on with my 2019 life, when that's just not the case. I've personally made a lot of sacrifices because of this. I avoid crowded places. I don't go to the pub. I've not been to the pub for 3 years. I've not been to a gig for 3 years, and I used to go every week to a gig. I'm not going to do any of that because it is just a risk I'm not willing to take. It's not safe. But a risk that I can't avoid taking as someone with a chronic illness is going to my hospital appointments, which I have to go to. And now these places are also, like the bars, like the restaurants, unsafe. But I can't choose not to go to them. I can't choose not to go to my hospital appointments. I can't choose to not pick up my medication from the pharmacy, because I will die if I don't take it, right? But I have to go to the pharmacy to get it. And this should not be my responsibility. This is the government's responsibility to make sure that using these public services and just being able to work and like be a part of society is risk-free. And they haven't done that. And this is a huge burden to bear, to manage, to constantly be managing your own risks and deciding if something is worth the risk for you. And I think it's because that is such a burden that a lot of other people don't tend not to manage their risks in that way, and they just go along with what's happening now, because that is they've been encouraged to forget about it by the government. And ultimately it is going to bite us all on the ass. And I'm just devastated that that's the case. That's where we are now. When we have the know-how, we have the knowledge, we have the information, we have the skills to avoid this, and we're not doing it. Like some sort of, it's like in the 19th century, when there was a lot of industrial illness going on at work, and the capitalists just said that, this is just the way it is. And then after the war, there was radical policy to like setting up the NHS that was about protecting people's health. It was about making sure that people's workplaces were safe, that their homes were safe, that their life would be a much better quality for the economy. People's health and well-being is the economy. And I think they just need to hurry up and realise that.
Well, I think on that very powerful note, I think we'll bring the recording to an end. Thank you so much. And I really felt your emotion there towards the end. I really appreciate you coming on to speak with us in such a passionate fashion. And I could really sense an urgency and care for your fellow Scot in order to protect them and both yourself. So thank you very much for that. If you
Thanks
are
for having us.
no worries at all. And if you are if you share Hannah's feelings, if you think that this should be repealed, then please join the campaign on Saturday outside the Parliament. What time did you say it was? At
Half
half
past
three.
three.
At half three. And is there anything else you'd like to add, Hannah, before we go?
Actually, there is one thing I would encourage everybody to go and look at. The British Heart Foundation have a really excellent resource on their website called the Coronavirus Hub, and there is really, really good information about the effects of COVID on people's heart, their vascular systems, their brain, how things like long COVID and ME can develop from a COVID infection, however mild that COVID infection is. And it's a really easy to understand, really good resource, and I would encourage everyone to go and have a wee look at that.
Absolutely. And if you I want to speak to Hannah, I'm happy to put you in contact. Just give me an email at ines@untribalpolitics.co.uk. Untribal Politics, as I said, is committed to giving ordinary folk that platform to speak up about big issues. If there's something you feel passionate about and you want to come, even if you want to come and join me and just have a blether on the podcast, please come let me know. You can email me at the same email, or you can tweet us at Untribal News. Instagram Untribal Politics, and thank you very much for listening. Take care.